chapter 19 together. And there are four sections to chapter 19. So rather than read the whole chapter, we'll go through it section by section. So let's commend ourselves to God first, and then we'll do a recap. Heavenly Father, we do thank you for this opportunity to meet on a Sunday night. Lord, as we think back to this morning, we thank you for our time together. And we thank you for hearing our God about the hope, the living hope that we have in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. As we turn our attention to Saul again this evening, we do ask for your blessing upon us. Our God, we want, as we said this morning, to focus on you. We want, our God, to immerse ourselves in you, to fill our minds and our hearts with God, that we might then be so filled with the fullness of God that we can go out into the world and we can make you visible to others. So our God, bring yourself to us in the text. Show us yourself in the verses that we will look at. And we commend ourselves to you in Jesus' name. Amen. So let's recap then. We've been some weeks looking at Saul, and we've seen that three men stand side by side. We have Samuel initially, who's the last of the judges. Then we have Saul himself. And then the story moves on to David. Saul is our main focus, and we'll focus on Saul, even though David has now come on to the scene. And then at the end of 1 Samuel, we'll make a decision about going on to continue with David. So Samuel then is the last of the judges. And we see him as a judge, a prophet of God's grace. Saul then is a king in God's place. And we thought a lot about that. We saw back in Deuteronomy that God had intended that the Israelites would have a king, but the reason they sought Samuel to give them a king was because they were tired of having to rely on God. So they thought that a king would be there in place of God. So Saul then, a king in God's place, and then along comes David, and David is a man after God's heart. So where we're at the stage where Saul has been rejected by God. He can remain king, but his son Jonathan won't inherit the crown. His house will end on Saul's death. And David has been chosen instead by God to set up a new dynasty in Israel. So it's a transition period. Saul remains on the throne. David is his musician, his music therapist, if you like. David comes along and plays the harp to soothe Saul when he is distressed. David has also had a great victory over Goliath, and we spent a few weeks looking at the account of that in 1 Samuel. And what we saw 2 weeks ago was Saul had determined to kill David. He kept it secret. His plan to end David's life. Now, in chapter 19 of 1 Samuel, Saul makes that plan to end David's life open. He has his counsel, his advisors. His son Jonathan is one of those advisors, and he informs them that his plan is to end David's life. Now, David has become his son-in-law. David has married Michal, Saul's daughter. So he's in the family. But there is this decision. It's a big moment because Saul has made public his decision to kill David. So if you've got 1 Samuel in front of you, there are four stories in this chapter, four attempts on David's life. So we need to just be familiar with each account. And then once we've got the account sorted out, we then seek to learn the lessons. And don't forget, we all know by now that when we read the Bible, we look for God. Our first duty above everything else is to find God. and to see what we learn about God. We don't come to learn about ourselves or to take any lesson about us. We are here to discover God. So let's look at these four accounts then. The first account of an attempt on David's life is from verse 1, and it's as far as verse 7. So this is account number 1. We'll read this one, we'll talk about it, and then we'll go on through the other accounts. So the first one then, chapter 19 of 1 Samuel, verses 1 to 7. This is account number 1. Verse 1, Saul spoke to Jonathan, his son, and to all his advisors that they should kill David. Now here's Saul then out in the open. He's going to kill David. But Jonathan, Saul's son, loved David greatly. Now we've seen this before. We've met Jonathan before. So Jonathan went to tell David, saying, "My father Saul seeks to kill you. Therefore, please be on your guard until morning." So the plan was to kill him at night. And that's very significant. Keep that in mind. "Be on your guard until morning and hide in a secret place. And I will go out and stand beside my father in the field. And there you'll be. And I will speak with my father about you. And then what I see, I will report to you." And so Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father. And he said to him, "Let not the king sin against his servant, against David, because David has not sinned against you, and his works have been very good toward you. For he took his life in his hands, and he killed the Philistine. And the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel. Now you saw it, and you rejoiced. So why then do you want to sin against this innocent, to kill David without a just cause?" So Saul heeded the voice of Jonathan, and Saul swore, "As the Lord lives, he shall not be killed." So Jonathan then went to meet David, and Jonathan told him all these things. And Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as in times past. Now, it's not very dramatic, but there's a number of things to notice about that first attempt on David's life. I mentioned already it's at night, and we're going to see that attempt number 3 will also be at night. You've got the idea of Saul being presented to us as we've always met him before. Now, I'm aware that we are Zooming, and when we Zoom a service, it's quite difficult, isn't it, to get any interaction going. But the first time we met Saul, he was out searching for his father's donkeys. Do you remember? And he'd gone a number of days looking for these missing donkeys. And he had taken his servant with him. Now, as we saw Saul on that occasion, so we see him again. What's the characteristic that we see here that we saw before about Saul? Anything strike you about him? What are we seeing again now in this first account? What's Saul always like? He's indecisive, Richard. So he's what then? Who makes the decisions? It's never Saul. It's always his advisors, his servants, somebody else. So here is Saul once again making a decision to kill David, but he's persuaded out of it. Somebody else comes along, like his servant back with the donkeys, and manages to be more decisive than Saul, lead Saul, guide him, direct him, persuade him, cajole him. And this is how Saul always presents himself. He's manipulative. You can manipulate him. You can decide for him. You can lead him. He's not the king who is decisive. He's a man who can be easily led. And once again, his own son, Jonathan this time, is able to persuade Saul out of his plan, make his decisions for him. Now, this is Saul's great weakness. He's indecisive. Others lead him. He's a follower rather than a king, and he's easily persuaded. He cannot settle to a course of action. So that's the first thing to note. And then if you look at the very last verse of this first murder attempt, if you like, verse 7. Jonathan calls David, and Jonathan told him all the things that had passed between him and his father. Jonathan then brings David to Saul, and he brings Saul into his presence as in times past. What's the word we are looking for then? Jonathan becomes a type in this first murder, a type that we see many times in the Bible, and it's a type that ultimately points to Christ. So I want you to kind of think about the term, the biblical term that we need to identify. So you've got an angry king. You have a subject who is the object of the king's anger. And in comes a son who then turns the anger of the king away from the object of his anger, and he brings them back together. Now, that role that Jonathan does, we've seen before. I'll give you an example. You see it in the life of Joseph, when Joseph goes to an angry Pharaoh and he manages to persuade an angry Pharaoh to remove his anger from the people of Israel, and he allows the Israelites to come and live in Egypt during the famine, and he gives them the best of the land. It's this idea of what? What's the biblical doctrine where somebody comes along and speaks up to an angry monarch or somebody who's powerful and angry? Esther does it. She takes it upon herself to go and do it in her story. Any ideas of the role of the person, the biblical idea that we've got? So mediated is one idea. There's a different word. I don't know if David said it. It's an intercessor. So what we've got here is the idea of intercession. Somebody coming along and interceding on behalf of somebody else. Coming to a powerful monarch who's angry, and based on who they are, so this is Jonathan, the son of the king. Joseph was the prime minister under the Pharaoh of Egypt. Based on who they are, they come along and they speak up on behalf of somebody else. And in speaking up on behalf of somebody else, they move the wrath and the anger from the king. And then the king becomes favorable. The king becomes, if you like, merciful instead of anger. It's not so much a mediator, Will, because a mediator tends to offer something. An intercessor is based on who that person is. So Jonathan, the son, and so on. Now, that idea of intercession, removing the anger of a monarch from the object of anger, the person who's made the king angry, that role of intercession, you see it here with Jonathan, you see it with Joseph, is fulfilled, isn't it, in the person of Jesus Christ. Jesus comes to an angry God, and he persuades an angry God, using this language very clumsily now, persuades an angry God to remove his anger from the object that he is angry with, the sinner, and then reconciles the sinner to God. What you're seeing in this first murder attempt is a hint, a glimpse of the biblical doctrine of intercession. Somebody coming into a situation, and based on who they are changing wrath to mercy. Now, don't go too much into, well, Neil, this is about Saul, an evil king, and so on. Don't go too much there. It's just presenting us with the idea of intercession and reconciliation. And I know it's only for a moment that Saul and David are reconciled, but it is there nonetheless for a moment, just like in times past, Saul and David are reconciled. Saul is reconciled to David because of Jonathan and what Jonathan says and who he is. So it's just a biblical example of intercession. Don't go too far down the rabbit hole there, but just recognize that. Does that sound all right to recognize that? So the first murder attempt is a presentation to us of the biblical doctrine of intercession. Somebody coming along and changing wrath to mercy. That's your first murder attempt there. Okay, so that's number one. I'll keep an eye on the time and let's take a look at number two. Number two is verses 8, 9, and 10. So it's a short account and it's one we've seen before. So let's read account number two of the plans to kill David. Verse 8, so there was war again. And David went out and fought with the Philistines and struck them with a mighty blow. And they fled from him. Now the distressing spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he sat in his house with his spear in his hand. Now you know, don't you, what's going to happen? We've seen it before. David was playing music with his hand, and Saul sought to pin David to the wall with his spear. But he, David, slipped away from Saul's presence, and he drove the spear into the wall, and lo and behold, what do we get? David fled and escaped at night. So it's another example of night. And what you have is this familiar idea of Saul, and that distressing spirit from God is troubling him again. Now, let's not discuss it once more. We've talked about it before. It's not an evil spirit. Saul is not being sent by God, a demon, to torment him. It's not that. We've discussed it previously. It's an episode where Saul becomes mentally ill. It's an episode when Saul is once again being overwhelmed with one symptom. Do you remember the symptom? Where he starts to focus on David and he sees how successful David is. David has slain his 10,000s. I've only slain my thousands. What's the word that we said characterizes these moments in Saul's life? What's that? Paranoia. So what seems to happen is Saul descends into a form of mental illness that is characterized by paranoid, delusional beliefs. So there he is, sitting there, feeling paranoid, and the object of his paranoia is David. And David's there playing the harp to soothe him. And Saul seems to be always carrying a spear at this point. It's never far from him. So that's part of Saul's paranoid ideas. He has to look after himself. So his spear is there ready, just in case. And as he's there, and you can visualize, can't you? Saul is sitting there and he's brooding and it's night and David's playing the harp. He picks up his spear and he launches it at David again. And David, we're not given the details, David slips away and the spear goes into the wall where David had sat. And David goes out at night. Now, that second attempt is familiar. You've seen it before. But what we need to think about is the idea of David slipping away. That's the Hebrew term. David seems to somehow, in mysteriousness, he manages to be able to remove himself from that present danger. And as he does that, and Saul is then left with his spear kind of waggling in the wall in front of him, he's not sure how David managed to escape. It's the idea of David escaping a present danger by slipping away. So as I said at the start, you need to find God here, don't you? How do you find God? You see it in the first murder attempt because it's intercession, and that's clear. God, angry at sinners, is an intercession, and his anger becomes mercy. How do you see God here? And the key to seeing God in murder number two is the word slipping away. There's an occasion when, can you recognize it? Jesus is amongst a crowd, who seeks to take him and throw him over a cliff. And what we read is that he is the same, is the Greek equivalent of the Hebrew word, he slips away. So what David in his experience does is he points us to a greater David who, when he is in great danger, slips away from that danger in a way that we don't know how. So David points to Christ in this second attempt on his life, and he points to Christ. I think it's in Luke 4. One occasion is in Luke 4 when Jesus is in Nazareth and he goes to the synagogue and he preaches from Isaiah. And then the crowd comes and they take him to the edge of the cliff in Nazareth and they're going to throw him off. He slips through it. That's one instance of how David foreshadows Christ on this occasion. Does that sound okay? Okay, so again, keeping an eye on the time there, let's look at murder attempt number 3. And you see it from verse 11 to verse 17. Shall we read it and see what we make of it? Verse 11, Saul then sent messengers to David's house to set a watch on him, to kill him in the morning. So it's another night. Is it the same night in which David slipped away from the spear? Now, Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, if you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you will be killed. So Michal let David down through a window, and he went and fled and escaped. And Michal took an image and laid it in the bed, put a cover of goat's hair for his head, and covered it with bedclothes. So when Saul sent messengers to take David, she said to them, he's sick in bed. Then Saul sent the messengers back to see David, saying, bring him to me in his bed, that I might kill him. And when the messengers had came in, they went to the bedroom, and there was the image in the bed, with a cover of goat's hair for his head. So Saul then said to Michal, why have you deceived me like this and sent my enemy away so that he has escaped? And she answered her father, he said to me, David, let me go or I will kill you. Now this is attempt number 3. And there's dangers in this. There's rabbit holes that you are not meant to go down. We are very good, I think, at going down rabbit holes. On a Wednesday in our Bible study, sometimes we do it, and that's fine. But don't do it here. The big false rabbit hole that is staring at you, that you're tempted to go down and you mustn't, is what? Where's the big red herring here? Which point is being made that you don't need to follow at all in this account? Any ideas? Sorry, why does Mitchell lie? Right, Richard, so we'll add that to our rabbit holes then. Don't go down that one, okay? We're not meant to worry about this woman lying to her dad, okay? Don't go down there, but there's a bigger rabbit hole. Sorry? So, all right, so well, we know where he goes, Julie, because when we start murder number 4, we discover he goes to Samuel. Okay, so he goes to Samuel. The big rabbit hole to avoid is, why does David and Mitchell or Michael or whatever we want to pronounce it, why do they have an image? An image is a household, if I can say it, a household idol. They've got a false god, and they have it as a household god. Now, why would David, who's a man after God's own heart, have a household god? So you see it there, don't you? Where is it? Verse 13. Mitchell or Michal took an image. It's a teraphim. Well, you've seen it in Joshua, you see it in Moses, you see it in the tents of the Israelites when they're wandering the desert, when they go into the land of Canaan. They have household idols. Now, it's a great temptation, and I'd love to go down that rabbit hole and say, well, why do they have such a thing? But that's not the point of the story. We always need to think about the point of a story, that the main thrust. And the main thrust of this story isn't that, or why Mitchell lies, it's how she, his wife, comes to his defense. So you can see how the story goes. She's in on the plot to kill her husband. So she must have been present in verse one. So she knows that her father intends to kill David. She knows that this is the night before the morning where they will kill him. So she knows all this. So she tells her husband, David, now look, tomorrow the plan is to kill you. So unless you escape tonight, you've had it. This is your last chance to escape from Saul. So she comes up with this plan to save the life of her husband. And the plan is, so you can see verse 12, the first part of the plan is to let David down through a window. So guys, come on now, what do we do? Who else has been let down through windows in order to escape? The spies, okay, so in Joshua's day, the spies who went into Jericho, they were let down. I heard somebody else say, Paul, he was let down in a window from Damascus in 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians 11, whatever it is. So you can go backwards to the spies being let down. You can go forwards to David, to St. Paul. He was let down. Anybody else? Sorry? Has anybody else ever been let down through a window? When you read your Bibles, make these connections. You connect backwards. And you connect forwards. So if you do that then, and make those connections, that's the way to build yourselves towards uncovering the meaning and finding God in these verses. So that's the first part of the plan. So maybe their house was on the wall, like with the spies. Maybe it was that. Down he goes and off he runs. And then she takes this image, you can see it in verse 13, puts it in the bed. So it's a fair size then. It's the size of a man, I suppose. She puts him in the bed. She puts goat's hair at the top. And the sheet is pulled up over the body and the hair is left. And there it looks like, and how many times have we seen this? Not just in our Bibles. We see the idea of somebody in bed, that you think they're in bed, ill, or sleeping as a cover. And the messengers come then, later on, before dawn, to get him, to take him to Saul. And she says, verse 14, to the messengers, he's sick. What's that got to do with anything? But that's what she says. And so they go back to Saul and they say, oh, we couldn't bring him, Saul, he's sick. And Saul says, what's that got to do with anything? Bring him to me in his bed. So there's a failure here on the part of the messengers, the servants of Saul. If you're going to kill somebody, why worry about them being sick in bed? What she's doing, she's buying time so that David can escape. But it's an irrelevance. So Saul says to them, you can see it there in verse 15, and the Hebrew is very angry. Oh, for goodness sake, bring him to me on his bed then, that I might kill him. And you're getting this sense of Saul's frustration at the failure of his plans, but at the stupidity of people. So what? Get him here. If it means bringing him in his bed, then do it. I just want to kill him. So off they go, back to verse 16, back to David's house, and they pull the covers back. And they discover that it's not David. It's this household idol. So they go to Saul and they say, it wasn't him all along. And then he calls his daughter. Saul calls his daughter, verse 17. And he says to her, and this is Saul again, demonstrating his paranoia. Why have you deceived me like this? Why are you against me? You're my daughter. I'm the king. This man is going to take my throne. He's going to take my kingdom. Why are you helping him? Why have you done this to me? Why have you sent my enemy away so that he has escaped? And then she says, he threatened to kill me. And so that's why I did it. Now, I'm going to leave you with some work to do. And in the first murder, intercession. In the second murder attempt, you can see David points to Christ, who slips away because his time wasn't right. Jesus said, no man takes my life from me. I lay it down myself. So because in Jerusalem, in Nazareth, in Luke 4, that wasn't his time, he slips away. There were other occasions when he did the same. So with this account, number three, I want you to find God. I want that to be our task during the week. What do we learn? How can we discover God in this attempt? You look back to the spies. You look forward to Paul, who comes down, escaping the governor in Damascus. How do we find God there? Okay, I'm kind of pointing you in the direction to go, and let's see what we discover, and maybe we can talk about it on Wednesday. Okay. Number four, then. Let's see if we can get number four in. It's verse 18 to verse 24. And this fourth attempt on the life of David is very, very bizarre. Let's read it. Verse 18. So David fled to escape, and he went to Samuel. And Samuel, this is where Samuel lives. He was in Ramah. And he told him all that Saul had done to him. So he and Samuel left Ramah, and they went to Naioth. Now it was reported back to Saul, take note, David is at Naioth in Ramah. Then Saul sent messengers to take David. So he's sending his police again. And when they saw, that's Saul and David and Samuel, when they saw the group of prophets prophesying, Samuel standing as leader over them, the Spirit of God came upon the servants of Saul, and they also prophesied. So the messengers, rather, the spies, sorry, that's the they there in that sentence. They see Samuel's prophets prophesying, and the same happens to them. Verse 21. It was reported back to Saul, who sent further spies, further police, further messengers, and they also were overcome with prophecy. Then Saul sent messengers a third time, and they also were overcome by prophecy. So he also went to Ramah, and he came to the great well that is at Sechi. And he said, where are Samuel and David? And someone, they said, well, they've gone down to Naioth in Ramah. So he went there, and then the Spirit of God came upon him also. And he went on and prophesied until he arrived at Naioth. He also stripped off all his clothes, and he prophesied before Samuel, just like his servants. And he lay down naked all that day, and all that night. And this is why they say, is Saul among the prophets? Now, it's very bizarre, this fourth attempt. And I just want to point out one or two things. And then hopefully, when we point out one or two things, we can find God together. So what I want you to kind of work out is Jonathan saves David in attempt number one. Michael saves David in attempt number three. David then goes to Samuel. So what do you expect? If Jonathan has done it in attempt number one, Michal or Michael in attempt number three, what do you expect if David goes to Samuel in attempt number four? You expect Samuel to save him. And you might expect that. You read it and thinking, oh, well, Samuel's now going to come to David's rescue. Samuel doesn't say a word. Samuel is like a cardboard cutout in this account. He says nothing, does nothing. So your expectations are challenged. You expect a human to deliver David, just like Jonathan, just like Michal. And this time, it's nothing at all to do with human beings. It's a very bizarre sequence of events. So there's Samuel, there's David, and there's the prophets. And the first police group arrive. And they're overcome with the Spirit of God. And they prophesy. Number two, number three. Three times it happens to the police force of Saul. And then what you get in verse 22 is you get the sense that Saul says, if you want something done, do it yourself. And you get that sense in the Hebrew of Saul thinking, oh, for goodness sake, they couldn't arrest him in his house because they thought he was sick. They can't do it here in this place. I'm going to do it myself. So Saul takes center stage. It's as if Saul comes out of the shadows. He's behind the scenes, he's manipulating events, sending his police, planning it all, getting others to do it for him. And in this attempt number four, Saul himself comes center stage and says, right, I'm going to do it then. So you see Saul the king coming for David, coming to arrest him. And what then happens is as Saul makes his way to the place where he's at, he arrives, first of all, verse 22, at a well. So do I need to say it? How many times have people arrived at wells? If you go backwards, who are we thinking about who comes and sits at a well and great things are done? Who are we thinking of? Jacob comes to a well and he sits there. Anybody else ever comes to a well? Well, that's going forward. So before you go forward, go backwards. Who else comes to a well? And Moses comes to a well. Okay, so a lot of events in the Old Testament happen at wells. Okay, now you need to think about that. What's that all about? And then going forward, as Anne just showed us, Jesus comes to a well in John 4, doesn't he? And he meets the woman of Samaria. All these events are all connected. You join the dots between all this, and you see how often in the biblical account you have these moments just like this. So Saul, first of all, comes to a well. And when somebody arrives at a well, whether it's Jacob or Moses or even Jesus himself, the person arrives at a well in a state of distress. Jacob does, Moses does, and Jesus does. When he in John 4 comes to that well, he himself is distressed. He's tired and hungry and thirsty. And his disciples go off to try and get some food. Coming to a well, a well is a place to go when you're in distress. So Saul arrives at this place, and his distress is he can't find David and Samuel. So just like Jacob and Moses and even Jesus, you ask somebody else who's there for help. Jesus asks the woman to give him water. Jacob does. The women are distressed, aren't they, because of the sheep raiders. So you come in distress and you ask for help. Wells are symbols of arriving in distress and asking for help. Now you take another step and you find God, okay? So he comes then and he's in distress. And he says, where are Samuel and David? That's his distress. And somebody says, so somebody else present at this well, just like Jacob, just like Moses, gives him the answer. And he finds where they are. So then he sets off in verse 23, and the Spirit of God, now think about that. Think about how a huge thing for Saul has been the Spirit of God. He was given the Spirit of God. The Spirit of God was taken away from him. And as the Spirit was taken away from him, Saul develops mental illness. David then has the Spirit of God instead of Saul. And here now, as he approaches Samuel and David, the Spirit of God comes upon him. He'd been abandoned by the Spirit for years. He'd been left desolate by the Spirit of God for years. And then suddenly, in a moment, the Spirit of God comes upon him. So verse 23, he goes on, continues in his journey with the Spirit of God upon him, and he's walking, prophesying, as he comes to Naioth. So he's approaching this little suburb of Ramah, prophesying. And then when he arrives, verse 24, he strips off his clothes and he carries on prophesying before Samuel, and he then lies down naked all day and all night. And then we get the proverb that we've met before. It was way back before Saul even became king. Is Saul among the prophets? Now, because time has gone, I'm going to leave you with this one, okay? Saul points forward a little bit. So don't go into the New Testament. He points forward to another king who is, and I'm going to use an odd word, who's degraded, who is brought into a condition of degradation, and he's in the fields, and he's not naked. Well, he probably is naked, but he becomes an animal. Who's that king? Nebuchadnezzar. So Saul points to Nebuchadnezzar. He points to the fact that he is being humbled and degraded further by God. And that's what happens to Saul. So he's naked, stripped of all his majesty, in a field making babbling noises, looking completely humiliated in front of his enemy David. And saw a Samuel who anointed him. It's a tragic picture. It's pitiful. It's problematic. It's worrying. It's uncomfortable. It's difficult to work out. It really is. But Saul is pointing to Nebuchadnezzar, who then gets restored later. Now, what I want you to do, just like murder attempt number three, we need to find God, okay? How do you find God in this picture? So I've actually given you two things to do. But let's do a few more guidances and then I'll stop. This entire chapter presents God to us as the one who protects David. And he protects David through ordinary means. That's Jonathan and that's Michael. And he protects David through extraordinary means. So murder attempt one and three, ordinary stuff. Human beings keep you safe. Two and four are extraordinary moments of slipping away and God then intervening directly. God stepping in and miraculously turning Saul into some kind of beast in the field. The ordinary in the hands of God and the extraordinary in the hands of God. Both are seen here. Both are equal. Both are from God. So if God can protect you in an ordinary way, he will. If God needs to protect you through extraordinary means, he will. Both are from God. Both match the threat that exists. So if God can keep you safe from a threat by doing something ordinary, he will. If God needs to do something extraordinary because the threat is extraordinary, then God will. So this is all about how God protects you. And David knows that God is protecting him because Jonathan told him, "My father wants to kill you." So David knows the threat he faces, and he then knows the God who is keeping him safe and protecting him, depending on what the threat looks like. So that's the feel of the chapter. So with that idea in mind, take a look at number three, take a look at number four, and we'll talk about it again. Let's pray, shall we?